Okay, so just to make sure that I'm not going to talk about nothing, knots or something.
Not knots. There are rumors we're going to get cancer, that we're going to get to talk about cancer and special relativity.
Okay, so I was listening to a lot of talks and then kind of, you know, thinking about like how to model tumor formation, how to understand how tumor is generated, multi-step models for tumor, and how cells crawl, how things move, and all sorts of things. And I just thought, you know, why don't I talk something slightly different? And I was going to do that in the afternoon when you are relaxed. And so I'm going to talk about cancer therapy, and this is something that kind of, you know, comes out from the study on maybe physics and mathematics of cancer, but not directly addressing that issue. Or maybe there are. But anyway, I thought I should mention about, you know, some of the issues in cancer therapy. My name is listed as Fuyuhiko, but that's a little bit long, so I usually use Fuyu, just Fuyu Tamanoi, okay? So we've been discussing a lot about signaling networks and how tumor cells are different from normal cells. And in fact, we work on signal transduction pathways as well. We work on this RAS signaling pathway as well as this PI3K/AKT/mTOR signaling pathway. And we've seen this kind of subway map before during this workshop, and a lot of things are known. So I think we get really deeper understanding of the signaling pathways. And that seems to, like, you know, suggest some of the molecular targets that could be used as a target to develop anti-cancer agents. So I think, you know, the kind of a dogma that you study molecular changes in cancer and then look at the target and the develop anti-cancer drug, I think, is a valid kind of idea. And I just wanted to mention a couple of things that I think, the reason that I think this is valid. The kind of the premise here is that you have normal cells which have signal transduction pathways and normal growth regulation, but then in cancer cells you have uncontrolled or unregulated regulation. And therefore, you could target one of these kind of players. And as we understand more players, we get more drugs that could be developed. So that's the idea. And in fact, I think there are a lot of promising agents that's been developed over the years. And for example, the HER2 receptor is overexpressed in breast cancer, and Herceptin has dramatic effects on 30% of the breast cancer patients who have overexpressed HER2 receptors. Now, other important ones include Gleevec and Bemurafenib, which is a BRAF inhibitor, and I'd like to mention about this more in detail. There are other inhibitors targeting like transcription factors and G proteins and many other players in the signaling pathway. And Louisa was mentioning about the targeting angiogenesis. So those are the kind of regular targets. Now, the ability to develop anti-cancer drugs comes from the from a lot of chemistry that's been developed around the target, especially around protein kinases. And for example, if you look at the structure of protein kinases, you can identify a variety of pockets within the protein kinases and that you can target the variety of small molecule inhibitors that fit into different areas of the protein kinase. For example, this one, you can see that this in the fits, I think it's into here, and this particular motif can be a scaffold that could be used to develop a variety of more effective inhibitors. You can have a different scaffold that fits into different area of protein kinase, which then can be used to derive variety of inhibitors. And likewise, you can do a lot of different things. And especially, there's this ATP binding pocket that could be used to develop a variety
of inhibitors. These inhibitors of protein kinase, they are not specific for cancer, right? They will inhibit any protein kinase, even in healthy
cells. It depends, you know, with the BRAF inhibitor. The BRAF inhibitor is specific to a mutated form of BRAF. So in that case, it is specific to.
So you can target these inhibitors to only hit mutated kinase.
That's right. That's right. So with protein kinase inhibitors, you know, the study has developed so much that you can target to mutated form, or in the case of BCR-ABL, you have the fused, the ABL kinase. And you can target that one and make the other ones not touched by the inhibitor. So you could do it that way.
So how much of this is just combinatorial testing and how much of it is real design these days?
I think it's both. I was going to mention, but there are a lot of screening centers popping up, right? And UCLA has a screening center as well. And we have about I think we have about 300,000 compounds or something, but other places have million compounds, and you can do a lot of screens to identify good inhibitors. But then the in silico approach, as you mentioned, the kind of modeling the active site and feeding compounds, I think that has really developed. So I would say it's a combination of both. Okay, so the BRAF inhibitors, I think, are the kind of really the ones that's capturing a lot of attention nowadays. And there are a variety of different compounds developed which all inhibit BRAF. And the reason that you want to inhibit BRAF is shown here, that the BRAF is mutated in a variety of cancers, but particularly in melanoma situations. So just kind of go backward a little bit. The BRAF is this RAF kinase that is downstream of RAS in the EGF receptor growth factor signaling pathway. So this pathway is activated by EGF receptor, which then the recruits GRAB2, which then recruits SOS, which then activates RAS, and then that activates RAF kinases. And that leads to MEK and ERK activation. There are three RAFs. ARAF is more like mitochondrial RAF, so I don't think that's important. BRAF and CRAF are important. But somehow the mutation occurs on BRAF in a variety of cancer situations, not on CRAF. So therefore, you can target the BRAF. Okay, now, did I say something wrong? Just stop me. So just look at the variety of skin cancer here. So the melanoma arising from skin cancer without chronic sun damage has 50% of the case BRAF mutated. And that BRAF is the V600E mutation. And then 20% of the case, NRAS is mutated. So in fact, NRAS inhibitors might be important for melanoma, which we were discussing, but we haven't developed anything yet. There are other melanomas, like this one is arising from sun damage. That has less BRAF mutation than this. You can have the melanoma arising in the mucosal surfaces. This one has more like NRAS. So depending on, there's a variety of different. This one is a G protein alpha subunit.
So are these all the same locus?
Locus meaning what?
I mean, which amino acid
is it's always V600E. Yeah, so why BRAF mutation but not CRAF mutation? That probably has to do with the structure of the gene or the DNA, that during the replication it makes mistakes. But overall, BRAF mutation is found in about 50% of the cases.
So if you block BRAF mutation, V600E, it sounds like a machine extended. So if you do that, it does a cancer cell have the ability to switch to more CRAF and more ARAF to pick up from BRAF?
In this situation, the cell becomes dependent on BRAF-dependent pathway.
Yeah.
So therefore, if you inhibit BRAF mutation, then the cells stop growing.
So these cell lines do not themselves in a cancer because there's a higher chromosomal instability. You might guess that they figure a way out.
That's a good point. So I was going to mention that, in the resistant situation, you have these NRAS activation, which then bypass BRAF and go to CRAF.
This is only one of several pathways.
Well, but this is, I think, like 25% of the cases.
So there are also other
pathways. There are other pathways, FGF receptor activation.
No, but also other genetic compensatory mutations.
That's true. So you could have several different genetic mutations that could bypass.
Yeah.
In AIDS, the virus also mutates to get around therapeutic agents. And what people there do is they have just a variety of different anti-age agents. And then they have specific dose regimens which are mathematically optimized to get the population as low as possible. So you hit
right.
People do the same thing with cancer. So if you assume that you're going to get these pathways, is there an optimal place where you would try to hit first the first, then the second, then the third to get total population down?
Cancer is already there.
Okay, I'm sure it is.
Well, at UCLA, I think there was a discussion about combining BRAF inhibitor and ERK inhibitor. And so combining that, but the effect of the multiple treatment, that has not been treated in mathematical equations or something. It's
well,
more
in
like
the case of, in the case of, Gleevec and other drugs that treat CML, it has.
Yeah.
So do they have time regimens?
They're models of what might be an optimal time regimen, whether people actually use that model, I doubt. But in general, cancer cells are smarter than viruses. The simple strategies for viruses don't always work.
Yeah, so I think the Gleevec story is very interesting because the resistance to Gleevec was discovered mainly in the active site where the Gleevec binds. So apparently the BCR-ABL kinase kind of acquires another mutation in the binding site, so it doesn't bind, so the drug doesn't bind. But it seems to me that with the BRAF,
that is very slowly.
That is very slow. But
BRAF works for your whole lifetime.
That's right.
In HIV.
Yeah.
You fail therapy.
Well, okay. So I think the HIV might be good kind of example for the BRAF story, which is developing now. And it seems to me that the BRAF. I was discussing this with Robin and Tom that. With BRAF resistance, apparently they come back very, very quickly. So it's kind of a rapid kind of emergence of resistant tumors. And those mutations seem to have something to do with bypassing, activating upstream EGFR or FGFR or RAS and bypassing this. So if you have NRAS, it talks to CRAF instead of BRAF, and you can bypass it. And the resistant tumors apparently come back in the order of months rather than like years. So we're not talking about like resistance being developed over time. It seems to be a very, very quick event that happens so rapidly. So I think just to get the time frame, you know, what you have is that, like, you know, you get response something like this, where you see the tumor shrinking. So this is the basal start of the tumor size. And if you look at the tumor size decrease in each patient who have BRAF mutation, V600E mutation, you get 81% response. So almost everyone responds, and they respond by decreasing the size of the tumor.
How do they become response?
The size of the tumor. Yeah, so it looks like this is each individual.
Response?
So this shows each individual person. So therefore, this person has 100% decrease. So complete disappearance.
Yeah. When you say it's 81%, it means 81% showed more than 30% reduction?
I would think some kind of reduction, 81%. And I think that's a good point, because it seems like it's not completely uniform. There are a variety of different responses. So the genetic background of the tumor or location of the tumor, how drug penetrate,
can we look at the correlation between the level of response and the time it takes to relapse?
Yeah.
Develop resistance?
Yeah. So I think my understanding is that this response occurs in 2 or 3 months period. And then the resistant tumors come back in 10 or 11 months.
Yeah, but the question is, those that show less response will show the resistance will become show earlier or not?
I think that's an extremely interesting question. I think that I have not seen the study on that.
Ashok, what did you say?
Yeah,
there
so
is correlation by the level of response and the time it takes for relapse.
So you can see variability in terms of response and the correlation with the resistance. I think that's an interesting issue.
Do you know if the resistant tumors coming back have the same, are genetically the same or different from the original tumor?
So they still have the V600E mutation.
Of course. Do they have additional mutations?
That I think that's been now tested by complete sequencing, and I don't know the exact result.
It could be epigenetic too.
Well, that was another issue, whether, you know, my hunch, although I'm not really, I don't have results on that, but my hunch is that, you know, the tumors kind of disappear, but then you have heterogeneous population to begin with. You probably have a small population number of NRAS mutant tumors, and they just come back. So it's not the case that you're generating something new. They're already there, and they come back, is what I think. And whether that can be modeled in mathematical terms, that'd be interesting.
The more diverse the initial community is, the worse for the patient. The greater the genetic diversity is of the original community.
Yeah, because you have better chance of like existing. Yeah, yeah. I would think that would be very interesting. But that has not the. I think we just started discussion about that point. This is the metastasized. So, I just took from a paper. The melanoma metastasized to the brain. I think these are the brain tumors. They can be after. I think it was a couple of months. The tumor disappears.
So we need to see melanoma cells. Yeah.
Okay, the number of issues about this, which I think could be further investigated. I think there are a lot of interesting kind of materials here that we don't, I think, you know, we need to kind of start analyzing.
Is that patient still alive with the enormous thing in his head?
Well, I think now it's, I think, yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah, this.
No, that'll be
bad. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
problem. Is that patient really that was reduced all the way, that enormous tumor?
It looks like this is after the treatment. Well, I forgot to mention one thing, I think. So the BRAF inhibitors were initially developed by Onyx. Frank McCormick developed this. And that one is called sorafenib. This turned out to target CRAF, not BRAF. So apparently it only works on renal cell carcinoma, but doesn't work on melanoma. So kind of they missed out. Other ones have different ones, but this Plexicon from Roche, the vemurafenib, is the one that seems to make miracles. And so you see television programs where like a person is almost dying and then goes to the clinic and gets this twice a day, and then the person just stands up and walks out of clinics or something like that. Right? So. Let's see. Okay, so another kind of main issue about the BRAF inhibitor as well as other inhibitors is the side effects. And there are common side effects with BRAF inhibitors, and there's a long list of side effects if you Google BRAF inhibitors. I just took some common. Yeah, so like, I'm sorry, this is a conspire. Yeah.
No, that's constipation.
That's both.
Yeah. So the common side effects are rash, joint pain, liver inflammation. I guess the drug goes to liver, and even though it's supposed to be specific, probably like maybe 0.1% of the time it inhibits normal BRAF.
Presumably the drug gets concentrated in the liver, so even if it's lower affinity.
I see. So you test in vitro and show that it's really low affinity, yeah. But then when it gets concentrated,
yeah,
in
the liver. I guess.
Yeah, that could be. Dizziness, dry skin, headache, muscle pain. Loss of appetite.
Are these all very very common side effects, like in 50% of the cases, or like people put it in drugs, they happen to 0.01%?
I would think that most people will experience this, but I don't know the number. Whether it's 50%. If you go to the web page, you see all these side effects. And if you click muscle pain, you go to another page that has all the drugs that will be used for muscle pain. So all sorts of things. The doctors apparently are very careful to look for these benign tumors or squamous cell carcinoma appearance. Apparently, squamous cell carcinoma is due to KRAS mutation, so that one is probably bypassing it. But it comes up very, very frequently.
Is this a side effect of the medication or a side effect of the main tumor?
This is a side effect of medication.
Okay.
Yeah. But because of all these, the patients have to stay in the clinic or the hospital, and the doctors have to keep watching them or tell them to come back very, very frequently to make sure everything is okay.
So if you take it twice a day, what's off?
More what?
Trying to be fine.
Okay. But anyway, I think the side effect is not trivial, and that if we want to make the treatment or therapy more friendly to patients, what would be nice is that if we give one drug and then let the person go home and then not worry about it for a while and then check. So infrequent visit is much, much better. And therefore, I think the side effect still is an extremely important issue. And yeah?
Why is there is no effect on the level of hemoglobin and the white blood count? So it has no effect on the bone marrow?
I think, you know, I didn't look at the careful study of the total side effect. And the effect on the heart is going to be extremely important as well. But I think these are the ones that's listed, so they're probably infrequent, is my impression. I may be wrong about it, though. So should be careful about that, I think. All right. So therefore, I think, you know, the delivery is still a very, very important issue. And I think, you know, this has to be kind of addressed. So I think, you know, the thinking is that, you know, the anti-cancer drugs, current therapy is that you just give the drug all over your body, they go everywhere.
Can you comment on small RNAs which are used as a anti-cancer medication, for example?
Yeah, so...
not the protein, but the gene expression of the protein.
Right, I think, you know, so we did that, we did the...
53 mutants are being...
Yeah, so we actually did the experiment to inhibit RAS by delivering, like, you know, the siRNA against KRAS, and then we can obtain, at least in tissue culture cells, the inhibition of ALK. So we could do that. Now,
a more fundamental way to address.
So therefore, I think, you know, in principle, you can really kind of look at this kind of thing, and you can think of using siRNA or microRNA instead of small molecules to inhibit the pathways. So I totally agree that is a promising way of doing it. In particular, there was a report that siRNA could be developed against mutated form of RAS. So we used that one, but unfortunately we cannot reproduce the paper that's published. So that unfortunately doesn't exist. But in theory, if you can completely inhibit the expression of mutant form of RAS without touching other, that's a very good point. The other thing is that the issue about the siRNA is the delivery, right? So you cannot just mix with transfection agent.
I mean, might do siRNAs. Do they have potentially fewer side effects because they only...
Well, I think, you know, there's a difference. You don't get acute effect because you're shutting down gene expression. So depending on the turnover of the protein, you might have a kind of longer delayed effect or something. So in that sense, I think small molecules might be better. But the specificity certainly might be better with siRNA, although there are off targets, right? So the effects. I was not going to mention about this, but you can deliver siRNA by using nanoparticles. And Mark Davis had this siRNA against ribonucleoside reductase that was delivered to melanoma by mixing with polymers. So the polymers kind of formed like aggregates with the siRNA inside. And then you can do that as well. We can do that with ours as well. So that's developing, but it's not going as quickly as I'd like to see. So it will take a little bit more time, but that'll be done. The problem with siRNA, my understanding is that the issue of patent, because Alnylam, I think, one of the companies, patented the use of siRNA. So you have to come up with siRNA that's not patent. But that's a different issue. That's a different issue. Okay, so I think we use nanoparticles to deliver drugs to the tumor. And when you do that, you not only can avoid side effects or decrease side effects, but also you can prevent premature release of drugs until they reach tumors. And then you can achieve controlled release. And I try to go to controlled release and finish my talk, okay?
So all these targeting, they work only against the primary tumor, but not against the micro metastases?
Yeah, I think, you know, we try to use like RGD that binds to integrin that's overexpressed in a variety of metastatic cancer. But still, that's very kind of crude, isn't it? Like, so we don't have really good targeting to metastasize the tumor. So I think that remains as an important goal, I think. About the nanoparticles, you know, we call nanoparticles like nanobus because they carry passengers to the place and then drop the passengers. So kind of like the nanobus idea, okay? And there are a variety of technologies that have been developed over the years. And of course, you have like liposomes that's already like doxylates. FDA approved doxorubicin inside the liposomes. They're like double layers membrane as well as monolayer liposomes. And in fact, there's a company that sells liposome already in a vial. You just inject your drug into the vial, and then your drug goes in because of patented osmotic pressure, which I don't know. So I was telling the company that they should call this liposome formulation vial cup noodle liposome or something. So you could just inject and then reformulate, I think. So there are a lot of kind of, you know, advance. You get the Abraxan, which is a taxol in the albumin shell, is developed by Abraxis Bioscience. That's now called Celgene.
It's a synthetic virus, right?
This one?
Yeah.
No, this is just a protein, albumin protein. It's like a protein shell. And at UCLA, Lenny Rome discovered this Volt nanoparticle that's like a protein shell with a small RNA inside, but he uses a protein shell to put drug in here. Viruses, I think a lot of synthetic polymers that they self-aggregate. Virus, and then lipid drop, and then we use mesoporous silica, inorganic nanoparticles. And we do this because we collaborate with Jeffrey Zink, who's in chemistry department at UCLA, who makes these silica nanoparticles. And a variety of other people use this. And so let me just mention about this. Okay, so the particles, just the size. So we're looking at a cell that has like 100 micrometer diameter, and this is the 100 nanometer size. So we're talking about something like this, and then this will go, a lot of them will go into the cell. And
endocytosis.
They are endocytosed. So for example here, if you have fluorescent nanoparticles, they go into the cells by energy-dependent class-link-coated Pitts mechanism. And then they go to the lysosome. Right? And but if you put a targeting moiety on the particle, they go through the receptor-mediated endocytosis pathway. This is the particle that Jeff makes, and we use these particles. And the particles were made by the sol gel method, which is the starting from the solution, you condense and get the particles like this. And maybe I should mention that one if I don't want to go too much into detail, I'm sorry. You start with a solution of this, and then you condense and you get these. And depending on how you do it, you get silica nanoparticles. Okay, and when you do this, you add surfactants such as CTAB, and CTAB will self-aggregate. So they form an area like this, and this will exclude silica. So therefore, you have empty space. And after the synthesis, you wash this out by acid ethanol, or you can burn it actually, but acid ethanol is better. You get rid of that, and you're left with lots and lots of pores. And that's why it looks like this. Looks like a honeycomb. And the size of this is, diameter is 130 nanometer.
But closer together, is this one of Allison's interaction?
We try to disperse them, actually. We try to avoid, you know, getting the aggregation. So I don't like this area. I think I'm going to separate them. And to do that, we modify the surface with a negative charge, which is by putting phosphonate. And that helps a lot. And after that, we sonicate a lot to make sure that they're dispersed before you use that.
Where does the negative charge come?
The negative charge is from the surface modification. We put phosphonate.
Where does it help you? Why does it help you have a negative charge?
So it repulses the negative. So both the particles are negatively charged, and they will repulse. You know?
Positively charged,
repulse, yeah, you can have positively charged particles as well. That's fine. However, we are finding that the negatively charged particles avoid going to the liver, whereas the positively charged particles seem to go to the liver. So
I heard that positively charged lipids are toxic.
Not always, I think. Depends. But they go to the liver and they are excreted in feces.
The negatively
charged ones seem to avoid going, accumulating in the liver.
Do you have any idea why?
Oh, because most macromolecules are negatively charged. So if you have a positively charged particle, it will tend to aggregate with other macromolecules.
But I think, you know, there's this,
transporting the blood does not play a role?
There's a system called reticular endothelial system in the body that consists of cells, like macrophage-like cells, which will grab nanoparticles. And avoiding that is a major issue. And it seems to me that in this case, we can avoid that capture by using this. But I'll come back and discuss that.
The reason I'm asking is because of the interactions that they have with the glycocalyx in the transporting the blood vessels. And maybe as you mentioned, the glycocalyx is negatively charged.
Oh, I see.
But you don't have such.
That's why people for drug delivery tend to use positively charged lipids, so they can get attracted to the negatively charged lipids of normal cells, infuse and inject. So people make the liposomes are typically positively charged lipids, so that they can fuse easily with cells. But a negative consequence is that positively charged lipids may force negatively charged cells, so they're also toxic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know the whole story about this, but let me show you the results. So, but before doing that, let me just point out the significance of having these pores. We calculated that there are 1,400 pores per particle that we use. So it's just full of tunnels, you know, full of pores. And we can put drugs in there like this. So here's a kind of a simple experiment, which is not really a controlled release, so kind of a very crude type experiment here. What we did is just mix these particles with highly concentrated solution of camptothecin, which is a topoisomerase inhibitor that induces apoptosis of cells. And we just soak them and then dry up. So what happens is by capillary reaction, all the solutions will go in. And this is in DMSO, and we just dry it. Okay. And after that, we check how much went in, because we know how much we put in, and we know how much is left in the solution after centrifuge. So we calculated that, and we get a rough number, which is 16 drug molecules per pore, which translates to 22,400 drugs per nanoparticle average. And the camptothecin is hydrophobic. They're not water soluble, or they are very, very weakly water soluble. So if you suspend this in the drug-loaded particles in solutions such as water or PBS, the drug doesn't come out, and less than 1% came out even after
transport. Which means the nanoparticle also has hydrophobic surfaces on the inside, right?
I don't think it's the hydrophobic interaction. It's more like, you know, when we dry it, we just kind of get the drug into the dry form, and it takes a long time
if
for them to get
there. If the surface was hydrophilic, yeah. Once the water gets in, your drug would be dissolved into the water.
The drug does not dissolve. The drug dissolves very, very weakly in water.
Okay.
Yeah, because this is so-called hydrophobic drug. And this has been a major problem with there has been a lot of problem with camptothecin, and you have to modify this to make it water soluble. And those are called the irinotecan and topotecan.
How do you get it to come out once the nanoparticles?
Yeah, so in this case, it's slowly coming out over hours.
It's a delayed release part.
Delayed release. That's the reason I'm saying it's not sophisticated as I would like to see. But
let me just, the detail. There must be some polydispersity in the size of your nanoparticles and pores.
Yeah.
Do you know how that goes? You know how much of different nanoparticles differ in size?
You mean the heterogeneous size?
Yeah.
So this is the average size, but there's a kind of the size heterogeneity.
Yeah.
I don't have the curve to show where the center is.
Mm-hmm.
But not that kind of, I'm not talking in mathematical terms. So. I'm not talking in mathematical terms.
It looks pretty polydispersed to me.
It looks quite dispersed.
Is that right?
Some pores would have probably 2 molecules and some 30 or something.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's a distribution there, you're right, yeah. Okay. So anyway, if you give it to cells, you kill cells. This is a colon cancer cell. You have chromosome disintegration due to apoptosis and activation of caspase.
Targeted to cancer cells?
Yeah, I was going to come to that one. I think maybe I should just get to that. Okay. So. What we know is what happens if you inject these into mice. And to look at that, we use a mouse with a tumor called xenograft tumor. So these are not natural kind of, the tumor in mice. You're transplanting human tumor into subcutaneous region of this under the skin. You take this mouse and then put the mouse into this constrainment device, and the tail comes out and you inject this, this kind of a, and then this is fluorescent. So we put FITSI covalently bonded to the particle, so we could follow the fluorescence of the particle, right? And to do this, we use something called Maestro imaging device. And you put a mouse right here, and then you can take the image of the fluorescence. And as you can see here, you see a little bit of kind of fluorescence here, because when you kind of inject the solution, the little bit kind of spills out. In fact, the blood vein in the mouse tail is so thin, it's just very difficult. And you can't do repeated injections. It's a little bit difficult. But anyway, the important point is this is where the tumor is. So in our case, it seems to go all the way to there.
What's on the other blind spots?
These, I think, are background. I don't think that this kind of autofluorescence of the mouse. And we check, I think we did 3 hours, 24 hours, and 48 hours.
What percentage of what you put in ends up in the tumor?
Let me show you. We did the silica quantitation, and but let me show you the distribution. I think one issue was I think the tumor is close to the skin, so maybe the fluorescent comes out better. So we did tissue section.
These little spots.
So what are these?
I mean, they
seem to be organisms. Shell was asking about that. They seem to be autofluorescence, and we be.
It's not autofluorescence distributed. It's autofluorescence associated, the very least, with some structures.
Could it be the ribs?
That could be lymph nodes.
For example, lymph nodes.
I see. We never checked that. Yeah. No, I think that's an.
Because it could also be that the stuff is accumulated somewhere else, in which case you may want to know, right? But, drawing on a line there, sort of on the left, right?
This looks like some kind of nodes or something.
That was really the purpose of my question. If you could quantify how much actually there and how much is there.
Let me. I think
The image prior to injection,
I didn't bring it, but this certainly was not there. I don't remember about these guys, you know. So I think we should look at that a little bit more carefully. So we were looking at different tissues. We cut out the different organs and then make thin section and look at the fluorescence. And again, the tumor was a lot.
What do the colors mean?
Oh, this is just H&D staining, so just regular staining, and fluorescence is right here. I was going to mention that. Okay, let's just go to this one then. So I think what we did is, I can't answer your question, I'm sorry, because I don't remember the total weight of each organ. We did nanogram per milligram, and even though the liver is small, the liver is pretty big, so in that sense, I think it could go up. This one is cutting the organs out, and then doing ICP mass spec.
But how was it targeted?
Hold on. But this one is a section, so tissue section. So I think the liver has a little bit, but not a predominant one.
You still see these little punctate.
Well, I think the punctate fluorescence. I think that one. I think.
They look strangely periodic.
Okay. All right. I should pay more attention to those fluorescence. That's probably important.
How did you get it into the tumor preferentially?
Well, okay. So I didn't show you this, but I just wanted to show you the best one. But the result I showed you initially, fluorescence picture of the mouse, that one has something similar to this, but we see a little bit more here, but we see tremendous accumulation in the tumor. And
why does it, if you go back in all the other organs, it's actually still accumulating after 48 hours.
Oh, I see. So this
and
is
whereas in the tumor itself, it's fallen by a half, by a factor of two. Why is that? It's been metabolized by the tumor, or?
So what we know is that, we can recover, 95% of the particles excreted from mice. So what we did is that we put a mouse in something called metabolic cage, and you collect the feces and urine, and then we know how much we put in, so we measure how much came out. And in 4 days, 95%.
So the metabolic rate of the tumor is higher than that of the other of the organs?
That I don't know, but I think, you know, it's not metabolized and destroyed, because we could actually see fluorescence in the urine. So the mouse urine is fluorescent. And if we look under the microscope, we see exactly the same size particle in the urine. But that part, I think we need, it's a little bit preliminary. So I don't think it metabolized in, particularly in tumor, and then get destroyed. I don't think that is okay. They seem to come out from tumor.
And the night course here is a different mice, right, to sacrifice a mouse.
So it's like, this is 3 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours.
It means three different mice, rather.
Three different mice, right,
so
right.
That's right. Three different mice, so
three
mice.
Yeah, right, right.
So you can how many?
We usually have like five mice per, like, you know.
It's per milligram, so I guess it's normalized. Yeah. It says it's nanogram per milligram, so it's normalized. It's nanograms per milligram, so we know the mouse is.
Yeah, no, I understand.
No, I think we do have, like, you know, a large number of mice to get standardized.
But the rate of uptake could be different than different mice, right?
Right.
So you're going to tell us about folic acid?
So I was going to mention that, you know, we for targeting, we use, like, you know, folate and transferrin and RGD. So folate is attached to this way, and the folate receptor is overexpressed in a variety of cancer in general, so it's not targeting to a particular tumor. We try to put, like, you know, antibody to the particle, and that was not successful because the proteins aggregated, so we weren't able to do it. So we're using these small, like, transferrin molecule or RGD, like cyclic peptide is what we're using.
Did you give it a therapeutic dose?
Hmm?
Was this a therapeutic dose?
Yeah. So let me point out. Another thing we did is to increase the amount of the particles that we put in, and we used, and then we look at, like, liver, kidney numbers, and we use the amount that doesn't seem to have any major effects on liver and kidney and blood profile. And that is the amount we're using. And what we do is we load camptothecin, as I mentioned, into this, and then inject it into mice, right? And so I think that answers your therapeutic dose, because we know that the amount we're using enables the tumor to shrink. And the example is here, where we have pancreatic cancer called MIAPACA 2 transplanted in nude mice like this. And so we waited until the tumor is like this, and then started injecting. And in this experiment, we did we didn't inject into the tail, we injected into the stomach, and then that went into liver, and then went all over the body tumor. Okay, and you can see that we're following the size of the tumor in terms of days, and you can see that the tumor control goes up, the tumor size goes up from 100 to 200. If you inject nanoparticles alone, that's yellow, that goes up as well. Just nanoparticles do not seem to do anything. Empty nanoparticles. Empty. Yeah. With the camptothecin, using the same amount that we use to inject in the nanoparticle, shows kind of variable results.
So injecting without nanoparticles.
Without nanoparticles. And then if we use the nanoparticles that does not have, that do not have targeting moiety, we get this kind of response. And again, we use like, I think, 7 or 8 mice per group. And then if we use folate targeted nanoparticles, we actually see the regression in about 10 days. So this is
okay. So how am I supposed to think about this? This folate that thing comes down, attaches the folate receptor.
Yeah.
And just the fact that the nanoparticle is near the cell and leaking out the stuff.
No, nanoparticles go in through the receptor mediated endocytes. They go in. They always go into the cell.
Okay.
Yeah, and release it.
And stays in.
Well, that's a good question. Apparently, they come out after 5 or 6 days. So they have enough time to release drugs,
so
but then they come out.
So your optimal release rate is about 5 days. You'd like the nanoparticles to release the drug in about 5 days, right?
Yeah, I haven't really measured the rate of release and other things. I'm trying to come back to that when we try to do
you
that, but not with this.
Changing the degree of hydrophobicity of the drug.
Yeah, we did it in slightly different way.
So these receptors are upregulated in tumors?
Overexpressed. Overexpressed. Yeah.
Same receptors on normal cells, just they're more of them on tumor
cells. Right. So if we take normal cells and then transfect DNA and overexpress, yeah, then you get more going in, and or you shut down. And
did you check if you take healthy mice? Inject the same thing?
Yeah. So we've been doing that. We've been injecting into healthy mice. And we can go up to a certain limit. I think it's always maximum tolerated dose, so I think you can't put in tremendous amount. But,
and the slow release is supposed to be good? I thought people had done things like...
I totally...
This where
yeah.
Once it goes into the lysosome
yeah.
of the cell, it immediately releases
yeah.
everything.
So we, I think, you know, I'm not going to mention too much about that. So we, at the pore, opening of the pore, you can put something called the nano valve that opens when the pH is low.
Yeah,
so when
right.
that, so that that particle is made. We've shown that it works in tissue culture cells. We just started mouse experiments with that at this point. Okay, so here's another one that I kind of like. This one, in this experiment, we didn't see regression. So we have a different nude mice, and this cell, the pancreatic tumor in nude mice, I think, was a little bit difficult to establish directly from tissue culture cells. So what we did is we maintained mice with the tumor, cut the tumor out, and then made it into like in bits, and then put into another mouse, you know, more mice. So, and then in this particular experiment, it took more days actually, I think, to get the big difference here, but I think, you know, at this point, you could see 40 days here, you could see control tumor sizes here, the nanoparticles, empty ones, the size is here, camptothecin gives like variable results, and the camptothecin in non-targeted, the particles show variable results, whereas the targeted one always gives good results. So that's one thing. And moving on to the kind of controlled release, and that's the part that I don't. Okay, so let me mention about, the one that I kind of answered in terms of the, in response to Hobby's question is these nanovalves, and we put a kind of a stopper so it's closed. And when the condition changes, like pH changes or reducing condition changes, it opens and allows things to come out. We're also developing one that is cut by like an enzyme. So you have a stopper and then you have a close. And then when the particle encounters a particular enzyme, such as like matrix metalloprotease, in this case, it's outside the tumor. They cut this and open space and the content comes out. So all these are kind of ongoing. But what I wanted to show you is the nano impeller, which is a simple one that has the modified pore. So the pore is modified by the addition of a light-sensitive azobenzene. So this one, see, in these pores, we put azobenzene here. And the idea is that the azobenzene will absorb light and they're photoresponsive. And if you have the light of 457 nanometer, they change the conformation from cis to trans like this. And at this conformation, they receive more photons, and apparently they go back. So what you're doing is to create oscillating motion inside the pore, and that results in pushing the drug out.
How big is the pore?
The pore is 2 to 3 nanometer, and there are 1,400 pores in it.
This size is 2 to 3 nanometers.
Yeah, so it's not big to put like RNA or something. You know, just we can't put protein, but we can put like
how
small.
How do you get light into your body?
Huh?
How do you get light into your body?
Well, that's another issue, I think. You know, the 457 is not a penetrating light. So, if you're using like, you know, colon cancer or stomach cancer, I think which have exposed part. You could go close and then shine light. You could do it. But for the deep ones, we have to use 2-photon therapy. And we're doing that with a group at University of Montpellier by the name of Jean-Olivier Durand, using a different dye. But that's still ongoing at the moment. You know? So the idea is that with like red light, you know, goes in deeper and then meet. The problem is that it's going to be too precise, I think, whether we can cover a certain area. I don't know.
Okay. Could you say again how these molecules get pumped out when these guys get sexually oriented?
Yeah, so this, I think, has to be done in more mathematical physics type. It's really good. But I think my analogy is that, you know, you put like, you know, kind of a fan, you put on a fan in the room and push things out. But what happens is that if you expose.
Why don't you push it in?
Well, it's first push it out. Because she's push it in. One way, but not on the other way. Yeah. So eventually it has to get out.
So it just makes it diffuse faster.
Yes, it just
gets sturdy. That helps a little bit.
I think that's a good point. That's a good point. So you're saying if this is wrong, that I'm writing
that in the way. I find it very nice, very exciting. That's why.
If this is this way or something, that could counteract. Yeah, I think you're right.
But you put them in at random, so probably.
Yeah. It's the best thing, really, is lining them up in the right.
So we observe
that it's coming out. So here's the experiment.
The temperature, which is higher than
yeah. So here's an experiment we do. You know, we take cells, cancer cells or whatever, and then we put we use propidium iodide, which is a dye that binds to DNA. And when it binds to DNA, it becomes red like this. So the nucleus becomes red, is what we see. And so we put these, so they go in and then expose to light, and we look for the appearance of red nucleus. And you can see, we put there's a cuvette here, and we put the cells in here, and we direct the blue laser here and expose it. And we expose about 5 to 10 minutes is what we usually do. And then we look at the appearance of red nuclei, and we could see them showing up in response to the difference in the power. And also, if we do 1 minute, it's less. And then if we do like 10 minutes, we get more. So we could somehow follow that, the release of the dye. If we take the cells exposed here and incubate longer after putting camptothecin in instead of the dye, then what happens is that we get exposure time dependent apoptosis happening. So in both dye and the drugs, they come out. So that doesn't answer your question, but they come out.
So with this, can you study circadian rhythm correlated drug response? there is a lot of evidence that it depends on when you give the drug. It seems to affect patient response.
I see. But that's a room light, right? The kind of
on
sunlight.
Mouse is on the surface. But you can shine light through the surface, presumably.
This one opens at a particular kind of, I didn't put it, but a different wavelength, the nanometer, they don't open. So the opening is pretty narrow. So yeah, that's the reason we can do this, because we can just do this and take it to the lab and then.
So you said this was possible to transmit small RNAs this way, or they were too big for the pore?
This is too big. Too small, I'm sorry. The pore is too small for small RNA. For small RNA, unfortunately, what we're doing is to make the surface positively charged. And we put polyethylene in, and then we add small RNA. It turns out small RNA will bury, go into the layer of the positive charge, and then we can deliver to cells and shut down any signaling pathway we want. The problem is that it's positively charged, and we haven't done the experiment in mice. They may not go to tumor, is what I'm worried about. I think there is a group that made a huge pore and put this RNA. I don't remember, Korean group or something, but we haven't been able to.
Here on campus, here, Safinia is using.
Yeah.
Lysosome
delivery of
RNA. Is this delivery
mechanism available?
Commercially available? Because
no.
What we do to transfect small RNA into cell lines is a big pain for bacterial.
Right.
It's a big pain. It doesn't always work.
Yeah. It's not commercially available, but it's available to anyone, I think. In the nanoparticle community, people just exchange materials. So, yeah. But anyway, here's the thing. We wanted to do real-time imaging of drug release from that machine in a single cell. And I think our paper just got published. So I just wanted to mention quickly here. In the end, we want to look at the drug release from a single machine or nanoparticle in a single cell, but that's a bit difficult at this point. So we don't have clear formulation of the drug release, but we could look at, so for example, this is one cell here, and you can see another cell, another cell, another cell, and you have the particles, multiple particles. You can actually put the cells here, right, on the slide. And then you can zoom and activate one cell. And we do that by kind of directing the laser to one cell. And then we follow the release of propidium iodide and staining of the nuclei. And the setup is not particularly sophisticated at this point, but we do get some kind of measurement, and again, I think this is really the beginning of looking at how these things work in a cell. But anyway, to make the long story short, we get something like this. So we look at a fluorescence after irradiation by the laser And then the particles are taken up into cells, and they contain propidium iodide. And propidium iodide has fluorescence. So we see the initial kind of peak of fluorescence that appears at about a couple of minutes here. So they see, I think it, in the minute range they come out. And then the fluorescence goes down, and then you get this big fluorescence coming up. And that fluorescence is happening much later, and so we take this peak 1, 2, 3, 4, and peak 2 and 4, we look in more detail. And it turns out that the fluorescence spectra of peak 2 corresponds to the peak of 670 nanometer, which corresponds to the propidium iodide in solution, propidium iodide, free propidium iodide. But if you look at this peak, you can see that it has the fluorescence of the peak of 625 nanometer wavelength. And that corresponds to propidium iodide bound to the DNA.
That's a standard chemical shift.
Yeah. So one thing that kind of confused us a lot is that the initial really high kind of level of fluorescence. So apparently cells have autofluorescence that gets quenched very, very quickly. And so we did the experiment. I didn't show this. We did the experiment without the particles, and then they go down like this. So if we kind of, you know, the if we subtract that, and that got us a little bit confused here. But if you subtract the autofluorescence, what happens is that you have an initial peak of this, and then this slow peak of this, which seems to suggest that you have this propidium iodide in the machine, and upon light exposure, it comes out quickly in the order of minutes. And then they will slowly go to the nucleus. They get into the nucleus and binds to the DNA and gives this big fluorescence. So we could actually follow the event in the real time.
So I saw that the last one was the shift of
propidium iodide. So propidium iodide shifts when they bind to DNA, and you get much stronger fluorescence.
So that's specifically for DNA, that
peak. This part is when it binds, goes to the nucleus and binds.
So is that the characteristic time scale for the import to nuclear port?
That I think is the case. So if we have a nice movie, but I didn't bring the movie. But
fluorescence appears
fluorescence. Now again, I think, you know, these kind of, you know, the speckles, you know, I don't know whether we could, but I think you should look at this kind of, you know, the homogeneous fluorescence there, and that happens in the order of 20 to 25 minutes, and you get.
Is that image, where is the nucleus and where is the cell?
This is just showing the nucleus. The cell is much larger, actually. So we're just looking at the nucleus.
That little bright patch now is part of nucleus.
Right. These are nucleus, yeah. So it's within the nucleus, there are autofluorescing kind of spots due to, I don't know, ribosome.
25 minutes is still a smaller part of the nucleus. That's.
Yeah, but I think what we're looking at is this kind of, you know, the homogeneous fluorescence that appears and then becomes very, very strong by 25 minutes.
The nucleus is still bigger than that,
This is the nucleus.
This is the whole nucleus.
The cell is like this. Yeah. So it seems like, you know, at least we can follow what's going on inside the cell. And this kind of shows, you know, that we can trace what where dye goes through. And if the condition in the cell is different, what happens? I would think that kind of a variety of conditions can be tested. We haven't done that yet. Just as I said, it's just preliminary results. Okay. That's the light response, and what we have is that, you know, instead of putting azobenzene in the pore, if we put azobenzene at the opening of the valve, we could have the light responsive opening of the valve and then allow the content to come out. We made this one, but not tested in cells yet. We've also made something that has a zinc-doped the particles. So you have zinc-doped iron oxide nanocrystals. So these are super paramagnetic have property, and if you put them in the oscillating magnetic field, they will oscillate and generate heat. And you can increase the heat and allow the thing to come off. And this one, Jeff Zink successfully showed this together with a group in Korea. We haven't tested this yet. So we're trying to see whether we could use a variety of stimuli to open the machine in the cell, and then kind of follow what really happens.
I was wondering about pH, because that's the clearest differential from inside, or potassium versus sodium. You want to have something which is a big contrast.
Yeah.
You know that the sodium concentration is high inside and potassium.
Yeah.
Or you can take pH.
Yeah, so the lysosomal pH is low compared to the outside. So when they go in, and using the pH difference, you can open it. The redox is also important because the redox condition is it's a reduced condition outside the cell, and then it's more
oxidated
inside the cell. You can do that.
So by putting it. Philosophy here of using the stimulus to control disease.
Yeah.
Targeting specificity?
No. No.
You can say you can target other particles, but that increase in specificity doesn't quite do it, so you want to sort of square the.
No, that's not the. That's not the.
So you want to target your release.
Yeah. That's right.
But these things seem terribly specific, right? So with magnetic field, right, you probably will not get that much resolution. Point of view,
just to get the drug out of the cargo instead
So I think the one that we are testing in animal right now is the one that opens by lowering the pH. So it's using the lysosomal pH.
That does not discriminate with normal cells.
Right. But we also put folate on the surface. So we put both.
You already targeted endosomes.
So we target the. So
the whole point is this strikes me as the possibility to square the probability of
but you
want them separate. You want to target the cells, but you want to release it at the right time.
So
once it's in the cell, you want it to go. You want it to open up.
The Boris is saying that you get other advantage that you could have light, for example, that was only targeted at tumor locations.
Yeah.
And therefore, you would get additional specificity.
But it seems we're not trying to
So we're not trying to compensate, the incompleteness of the targeting by using controlled release. Ideally, we want to use both and build in everything in one particle. That's the goal. But if it's kind of gave you the impression that we were trying to do that, that's not the case, because we are trying to put both in and then do it. Okay. Yeah. All right. okay, so So let me point out. Okay. So I think, you know, the controlled release is still kind of a major goal in, like, you know, cancer therapy. And so targeting might be kind of on the way, but I think building controlled release on top of that would be extremely important. And we're trying to do that by forming this nano machine center at UCLA. And Jeff Zink is a material scientist who makes silica and came up with the idea of putting a lot of machines, nano machines with Fraser Stoddard, and the nanovalves, and he came up with the idea. And we've been testing in cells and mice. And I'll stop. Thank you.
You never used the immune system response, right?
Yeah,
You haven't tried to, could you imagine using the same targeting to simply put an antigen on the surface of its cancer?
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't it similar?
No, I think,
then you don't want to go inside the cell.
Yeah, more technical problems, I think, more to do with, like, you know, the targeting moieties, I think, you know. Like, if you use, like, proteins, antibodies, I think we have not been able to perfect. So they seem to aggregate. Now you can use something called a small portion of an antibody, called diabody or something, and you can do that. But we have not been able to do that yet. Okay.
Thank you.